Every wedding DJ cues it up. Every graduation hall erupts the moment the riff drops. Yet most dancers sliding across polished floors have no idea that the woman behind the electric slide fought a half-century battle against industry sexism, political turbulence, and a brutal silence that once threatened to erase her voice forever. This is the hidden story of Marcia Griffiths, child prodigy turned global anthem maker, a queen who kept singing while empires of men tried to pocket her royalties and her legacy. From Kingston yards patrolled by colonial patrols to concert stages lit by international spotlights, her footsteps trace not only the rise of reggae, but the resistance spirit of the Caribbean itself. So, if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform and leave us a comment, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. Chapter 1. Sparks in a Powder Keg. The girl who would one day lead a million line dancers first lifted her voice in a two-room zinc roof cottage in West Kingston. November 23, 1949, Marcia Lyneth Griffiths inhaled Jamaican salt air, mixed with kerosene smoke and British rule. It would take only 15 years for that same air to carry her to the stage of the National Arena, where Byron Lee's band roared behind her. Singer Philip Bosie James had heard her humming through a cracked wooden fence and dragged her to the microphone. She nailed No Time to Lose on the first take. Coxon Dodd of Studio One signed her the next morning. Studio One in 1964 was more battlefield than studio. Male artists jockeyed for the producer's ear, while teenage Marcia squeezed through cigarette smoke and cables, clutching her notebook of melodies. Her first single, Feel Like Jumping, blasted from taxi radios across Kingston, turning yards into pop-up street dances. Yet pay envelopes came in half crowns, while her male counterparts counted pound notes. She learned quickly that a woman had to sing twice, smile once, and never flinch. Her next pivot was historic. Bob Andy, a fellow Studio One stalwart, asked Marcia to form a duo. The name was plain, Bob and Marcia, but the sound was anything but. In 1970, their cover of Nina Simone's Young, Gifted, and Black rocketed to number 5 on the UK charts, giving British kids an anthem of Caribbean pride. On tour, they faced skinhead mobs and hotel managers who refused to honor their booking. Night after night, she steadied the microphone, even while bottles flew. Each bruise hardened her stance. Reggae was more than entertainment. It was dignity amplified. Yet, Kingston streets could be harsher than English pubs. Political turf wars turned dance halls into no man's lands. The crowd stilled. The shooters lowered their weapons. Word spread that her voice could still violence. That night she realized music was her shield and her sword. Legend says opportunity knocks. For Marcia, it howled like a rebel wind named Bob Marley. In 1974, she and vocalist Rita Marley and Judy Mowat formed the i3s, the harmonic engine behind Marley's uprising-charged concerts. Every rehearsal was boot camp. Marley demanded perfect pitch under open-air conditions where gusts of ganja smoke and generator hum blurred monitors. She matched him, note for note, forming a wall of sound that turned stadiums into sanctuaries. Yet reporters wrote headlines about Marley alone, cropping women out of photographs. On tour in Zimbabwe's independence celebration of 1980, government forces fired tear gas into the crowd to control ticketless revelers. Marley halted the set. Marcia, eyes burning, led the i3s in positive vibration anyway, guiding tens of thousands through choking haze. She kept singing until her dress stuck to her skin, with sweat and tear gas residue. That night, she crawled into her hotel tub and wept, Tomorrow she would rise, repress the dress, and do it again. When Mali died in 1981, the media wrote epitaphs for the I-3s too. Marcia refused that funeral. She returned home and walked into Bunny Wailer's modest Kingston studio, carrying a cheap rhythm box she had bought in Toronto. They toggled buttons until a peculiar pulse emerged. Bouncy, synthetic, irresistible. Bunny scribbled lyrics about an electric boogie. Marcia laughed at the playful vibe, but recorded it anyway, her voice gliding over plastic beats. The original 1983 release went nowhere beyond Jamaican charts, but something about that digital riff stuck in diaspora parties. She performed it at a Brooklyn club in 1986. By 1989, Island Records demanded a remix for American radio. Marcia recut her vocals, this time with a crisp snare and a submarine depth bass. The results slipped into Billboard Hot 100 at number 51 and never truly left global playlists. But the windfall she expected never came. Royalty statements vanished into labyrinths of sub-publishers. Phone calls met polite transfers that ended in static. She learned the hard arithmetic. 100 million dance floor spins could still equal an empty mailbox if paperwork was cooked right. Still, she toured relentlessly, raising two children after their father died in 1983. In the late 1990s, an urban legend surfaced that Electric Boogie was a secret ode to a vibrator. Tabloids ran with the clickbait. Marcia had to face radio interviewers who smirked through the question. She calmed. By the dawn of the millennium, her concerts mixed three generations. Elders who remembered Studio One, parents who knew I-3's harmonies, and kids who only cared about mastering the electric slide. She stood center stage, watching entire gymnasiums pivot left then right in synchronized delight. Each slide felt like a vote against the erasure she once feared. Chapter 2. The Crown and Its Shadows. Marcia's 50th birthday arrived with a storm. Hurricane Ivan ripped roofs from Kingston in 2004, including part of the rehearsal hall where she stored vintage master tapes. Rainwater nearly wiped her archive. She dried reels in sunlight like laundry, then brought them to a mastering lab for rescue. The engineer discovered alternate takes of Truly and unreleased duets with Gregory Isaacs. She realized her own history was still hiding from her. The same year, Toots and the Maytals invited her onto True Love, an album packed with American rock royalty. The record won the Grammy for Best Reggae Album and thrust her back onto red carpets she had long avoided. She wore a gown stitched by a downtown Kingston seamstress, choosing authenticity over designer logos. Reporters asked how it felt to be rediscovered. She corrected them. She had never gone anywhere. The world was simply catching up. Yet the business side of reggae remained treacherous. Contracts written decades earlier in colonial English continued to siphon revenue. One afternoon inside the offices of an international label, a junior executive offered her a new compilation deal. The advance was generous, but the recoup clause would lock streaming royalties for 30 years. Marcia paused, looked the young man in the eye, and told him she had learned enough to read footnotes. She walked away. Outside corporate boardrooms, she found power in community. Downtown Kingston music schools invited her as a patron. She began teaching young girls stagecraft, how to breathe from the diaphragm, how to plant feet so no promoter could shove them off stage, how to negotiate a fair fee without apology. Watching shy teenagers morph into fearless vocalists gave her a satisfaction radio charts never could. On August 6, 2014, Jamaica's Governor General pinned the Order of Distinction, Commander Class, onto her turquoise dress while the national anthem played. The crowd cheered, "Queen Marcia." She smiled, yet part of her bristled, Why had it taken 50 years for her own country to formalize what fans had known for decades? 9 years later, the island corrected itself more boldly. October 16, 2023, Marcia Griffiths received the Order of Jamaica, the fourth highest national honor. The ceremony unfolded on the lawns of King's House, the very colonial estate where governors once plotted to stifle black music.
Flashbulbs erupted. In her acceptance speech, she thanked her late mother, her children, and every selector who ever spun a Marcia record under a starlit sky. Hours later, she slipped away to a quiet veranda and listened to tree frogs. Awards felt nice, but she still measured success by sound waves rolling through speakers in tiny street corners. That night, she opened her phone. A teenager from Lagos had posted a dance clip tagged Electric Slide Challenge. The clip reached 2 million views in 12 hours. Her voice had leapt across oceans again, renewing itself in bodies she would never meet. She whispered, "Keep moving." Yet, celebration invited fresh questions. If Marcia could last 60 years, why did so few women in reggae reach album 3? Why did labels still market female voices as decoration for male leads? Why do European festival posters print women's names in smaller fonts? The empire shifted shape, but its glass ceiling still shimmered overhead. She challenged press conferences with one demand: count the number of queens on your lineup next year. In early 2024, she toured South America. In Sao Paulo, a reporter asked if she ever considered retirement. She laughed, pointed at the stage, and said, "That mic is my passport. I cannot retire from breathing." The show that night stretched past midnight. During her encore, she fused Young, Gifted, and Black with a Portuguese rap verse by local activist Emicida. The arena shook. History and present danced together. Back in Kingston, she faced another battle: archival justice. She partnered with the Jamaican Music Copyright Collection Society to chase unpaid mechanicals from European pressings dating to 1970. Filing cabinets surrendered dusty spreadsheets showing that agents had collected in her name but never forwarded. The total surpassed seven figures. The discovery stung, yet it also validated every instinct she ever had about missing statements. Negotiations continue today, but she sings lighter, knowing numbers finally match reality. On her 75th birthday in 2024, she hosted a free downtown concert titled Slide Into Freedom. She invited the girls she once mentored on stage. 25 young women formed a living choir behind her. They sang Electric Boogie, then broke formation to perform the slide. Marcia stayed still, watching them claim the dance as their own. She realized legacy is not a museum artifact. It is kinetic, surviving only when bodies keep it alive. The night ended with fireworks over Kingston Harbor, yet the biggest explosion happened online. Hashtag #QueenMarcia trended across the Caribbean diaspora. TikTokers compiled clips of her from 1964 to 2024. The collage revealed the same bright eyes, the same measured sway, the same unwavering pitch.
Commenters debated which era was best. She answered in an interview the next morning, "My best era is tomorrow. I sing there already. Now the questions fall to us. Do we celebrate female pioneers only after they pass 80? Why do rumors, whether about vibrators or vanished royalties, stick harder than verified facts? When a nation finally crowns its queen, is it honoring her or correcting itself? And how many more Marcias are still singing in small bars, one contract away from silence? Your playlist choices, your festival tickets, your streaming pennies decide. The dance floor is a voting booth. Step wisely."